Welcome to the fourth episode of the Texas Observer podcast. This is Jonathan McNamara, web editor extraordinaire, and I have with me today Texas Observer staff writer Forrest Wilder.
Hey.
Also, Texas Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque.
Hello.
And a contributing freelance writer, Robin Ross.
Hello.
How's it going, Robin?
It's good. Glad to be here.
Good. I'm glad you guys could all make it to our fallout shelter in the bottom of the Texas Observer offices. We are not really safe from nuclear war. Don't believe the hype. But we do have two very interesting topics to go over today. We're going to talk a little bit about whether or not humans and dinosaurs may have coexisted in Glen Rose, Texas. And we're also going to talk about an influx of Central American kids that are now being housed in an Air Force base. Do I have that right, Melissa?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Well, let's start with you.
Okay, sure. Well, recently I've been looking into a huge influx of kids who have come over from Central America without any parents or adult relatives. And there's been so many in recent months that the government is not sure where to house all of them. And so last week they decided to put more than 100 of the kids at the Lackland Air Force Base, where they're being temporarily housed until they can figure out where to send them. And they've had about 5,000 kids come across the border since the fall. And usually, typically in Texas, we get about 7,000 to 8,000 kids a year, unaccompanied kids. So this year we're already at 77% more than we normally get. So the government, the state government, and the U.S. government are trying to figure out what is going on.
What have you found out? What is going on?
Well, I have my theories. Because these are kids and they're undocumented and they're not traveling with adult family members, it's very difficult to ever get an interview with one of these kids because they're under the custody of the U.S. government. And so I haven't been able to talk to any of them face-to-face. But one of the big theories and the one that I think is causing it is the security crisis in Central America that's been going on probably for about the last 3 years and has continued to get worse. And it's because organized crime, the drug cartels, are being pushed south out of Mexico and into Guatemala and El Salvador and other Central American countries. And they're displacing these families. Most of these kids who are coming across the border are boys ages 14 to 17. And these are boys who are really susceptible to being recruited by the cartels or by gangs who are working with the cartels. A good portion of the kids are coming from Guatemala and El Salvador, which are two of the most affected countries right now in Central America. Well, Honduras is really also has, I think, the highest murder rate now in Latin America. Much higher than Mexico, even.
What's the term that the U.S. government uses for these youth?
Unaccompanied alien children.
And that basically, this is a child that's under or teenager under the age of 18 who's not coming with an adult, right? They're flying solo, so to speak, when they're apprehended.
Right, and typically the children that we get who are unaccompanied are between the ages of 7 and 18. Most of these kids are between the ages
as young as seven.
Yeah,
they're coming by themselves as young as seven.
Yeah, or they'll come with an older brother or sister, or yeah. So
what's the policy here? Because I mean, this obviously anytime you're dealing with a child and the system, I mean, there's some special considerations that come into play, I imagine.
Right. Yeah. They're detained by Border Patrol and ICE down at the border, and then there's a certain amount of hours that can pass before they have to be put in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee and Resettlement. They have custody of the kids, so they're not held with adults for very long, is the idea, like they used to be. They had a change in the law a few years ago. So these kids are supposed to go to special youth shelters that are overseen by the Department of Health and Human Services. And what's happened is that they've just completely overflowed. They've gotten so many kids that the normal shelters that they use down along the border, they don't have space. So these kids are sleeping in hallways and they're sleeping in offices. And they've had to send them further into San Antonio and other places in Texas and the interior to find them beds.
And apparently also Air Force bases. I was going to ask, like, what is life like for these kids, like, at the base?
Well, that's a good question, and I've been talking to nonprofit groups that usually work with these kids, and they say they haven't had access to these kids yet at Lackland Air Force Base, although I talked to a group called Raices in San Antonio who has lawyers and so forth, and they provide legal services to the kids because a lot of these kids have relatives in the United States, so they can be reunified with family members. And so what they say is that actually the kids are coming into the Air Force Base, but they're being cycled out into shelters. So they're probably not going to stay very long at the Air Force Base.
So it's like a hub.
It's like a hub where they bring them up from the border, they stay for a week, and then they send them somewhere else, is what it sounds like they're doing.
And what what's the process to decide what ultimately happens to these kids?
Well, if the kids have lawyers, they have a really good chance of being reunified with family members here in the United States. But the problem is there's just not enough lawyers, pro bono lawyers, who do this kind of work. And so if the kids don't have lawyers, then often they end up signing voluntary departure slips and getting sent right back to Central America.
I mean, these are, okay, how does a 7-year-old understand some legal document to sign or not sign?
Well, they don't, and that's the crazy thing is that, you know, I was talking to a man who works with this, with these kids, and he said, you know, I've seen a line of children basically walked into a immigration courtroom, you know, and read their rights and everything, and he's like, and I remember this little 6-year-old girl in pigtails, you know, and here's this judge explaining all these things to her, and she's just looking around blankly like, you know, she didn't understand anything.
Was it in English?
It's in English, I think, but then they have a translator.
Yeah. So one thing you were talking about that, I mean, it's in your piece that you did for the Observer website, just that you had some trouble getting an explanation from the authorities, whether they be government or they be like a refugee service, an NGO. So there's some difficulty in getting accurate information about precisely what's going on, even the numbers of kids that we're talking about, right? So what's the reason for folks being so tight-lipped, do you think?
Well, I think there's political considerations also. I think that if the U.S. government acknowledges the crisis, the security crisis that Central America is having right now, and Mexico, which, I mean, they have acknowledged to a certain degree, then we realize that this is really a humanitarian crisis and that the U.S. government needs to respond in some sort of meaningful way. I think right now it's being treated more like a border security issue than it is a humanitarian crisis, and I don't think they're really acknowledging the fact that this is probably a response to Central American governments really, really teetering on the edge of, really trying to battle this drug trafficking organizations, which are hugely powerful and have a lot of money.
Do you see that changing anytime soon, or is this a problem that's going to persist?
No, I mean, I don't see it. I don't see it changing anytime soon, and I think the U.S. government has paid way too much. Well, I won't say that. I'll say that the U.S. government is very, very much involved in the Middle East and has been for the last decade. We have two wars going on over there. There's issues with Syria and Libya and Egypt, and there's so much going on over there that I don't think the U.S. government has really paid that much attention to Latin America in quite a long time. And I think that the situation is becoming more dire down there, and I think that the government does need to pay more attention and acknowledge the crisis and probably spend some more resources there and really start paying more attention to the issue. Because you see here with this influx of children, it's not something that we can hide from. We're going to feel it here, and I think we already are with these kids showing up here.
Yeah, I'm struck by I mean, it's sort of predictable, I guess, in a sense that the government doesn't really particularly want to talk about this crisis of children crossing the border by themselves. But there really hasn't been a whole lot about this from what I've seen in the press, or you don't see a lot of like NGOs or immigrant rights groups kind of shouting from the hilltops about this going on. I find that kind of peculiar.
Like, who are the people who are trying to get information out about this and like tell this story and advocate for these kids?
Well, the people that I've talked to are all very much care about these kids. I mean, there are a lot of nonprofit groups working, lawyers and people providing care that do very much care about them, but they're very hesitant to speak with the media. I think they're really afraid of how the story will be framed because immigration is such a polarized issue, and it so often becomes anchor babies or something like that, you know. So I think they're very, very shy about speaking to the media, and also because these are kids who aren't traveling with adults. So the government is very careful about granting any kind of access to them.
But it's not necessarily just that the story can be told without necessarily talking to the kids, although obviously that helps. You want to figure out why they left their home countries and traveled, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles to come to foreign land all of a sudden and in mass. But it's sort of beyond that, in that it's like this sort of silent crisis or phenomenon that's happening with virtually no attention being drawn to it. Or is that starting to change a little bit as it persists?
No, I think there's just nobody really paying much attention. I think it's a shame because these days everything is treated as sort of a political immigration issue instead of a humanitarian issue. I mean, I see this as a humanitarian issue. I see the whole continent as being sort of connected, and there's everything has a cause and effect. So it should be really a humanitarian crisis, and I think it should be written about in that manner and treated that way, but it's being treated more as a border security issue and maybe an immigration, you know, these are just more undocumented people. So
how do these kids get around the border wall? Actually, but a serious question though is, were they apprehended at the border, or is this the case? I mean, a lot of people who understand how the asylum process works, and I guess really we're talking here mostly about adults, you know, will show up at the border and say, you know, I want asylum. What was the story for these kids, or do we even know how they're apprehended?
Well, when I did my story 2 years ago, Children of the Exodus, on unaccompanied minors who were deported back into Mexico, I didn't unfortunately get to speak with any of the Central American kids because they were being detained on the Mexican side by Mexican immigration, and they didn't want to do any interviews either. But I would see them. I would see them taking them, you know, from the river all muddy into the office and talking to them. And so what typically happens is Mexican immigration detains about half the kids and sends them back to Central America.
And before they get to the border? Before
they can cross into the U.S. Okay. side of the border, they get them at the river. And then the ones they don't get, the U.S. gets about another 50%, and then 50% make it into the interior of the United States.
So a quarter,
yeah,
roughly,
yeah,
of all that attempt the crossing.
Right, right. So you times 5,000 by, you know, the 50 or the quarter that are picked up on the Mexican side, and then the quarter that get into the interior. It's quite a lot of kids.
Like, what is that, 1,250?
Yeah.
I guess we're ballparking here.
You're better at math than I am.
I think that's right. Well,
but yeah.
Can judge.
I checked the Mexican immigration statistics, and their amount of apprehensions has doubled also in Mexico of Central American kids. Huh. So.
Is that, I guess that raises the question of the border between Mexico and Central America. Is there something happening there that is maybe related to the spike that we're seeing at the U.S.-Mexico border? Or is it just simply, like you were suggesting, the explanation is there's just more kids fleeing El Salvador, Guatemala, and some of these other affected Central American countries?
Well, the northern border of Guatemala and Mexico on the Guatemalan side is being invaded by Zetas. So a lot of those kids, I think, may be coming from that area. I mean, that's just, you know, conjecture.
Yeah. But
I think a lot of people are being displaced. I did read one account of a Salvadorian couple who had been living here undocumented for 5 years and paying protection for their kids back in El Salvador so that they wouldn't get harassed by the gangs. And the threats got so bad that they decided to go down there to El Salvador and pay a smuggler to bring all their three kids. They were all, I think, two teenage boys and a teenage girl back to the United States because that was the only way they felt that they were going to be safe. And so they did that, and they made it, and then they were detained in the U.S., and now they're waiting for a court date. So, because also there's been a huge increase in families, so it could be that that's what parents are doing is they're being told by relatives, I can't keep your kids safe anymore because the gang violence has just gotten so out of control. You need to come down here and do something, get them out of the country or take them somewhere else, you know, to the United States or so. And it's getting worse. So I don't see this as being.
This is interesting because this is at a time when net migration to and from Mexico is basically zero.
Right.
Which is a sort of landmark moment in the, you know, history of immigration between the U.S. and Mexico.
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting time because migration has gone down, but the people who do come here, I think, are in really desperate, dire straits. So we're going to see like a lot more asylum cases, a lot more cases of, you know, people who say they were tortured. So the people who do come here are going to be in pretty bad shape. They're not just coming to look for a job, you know, they're coming because they're fleeing for their lives, basically. So I think that's going to be the new group of migrants that we see.
Well, Melissa, thanks for your report. We're going to go from that to a slightly more lighthearted, though no less passionate subject, and talk about creationism in Glen Rose, Texas, with Robin Ross. Now, you wrote this piece. It's been on the website for a few weeks now. And it's basically about tracks that sort of have evidence of human footprints and also dinosaur tracks in the same place. Is that about right?
Right. And when I started researching it, it turns out it's a little bit more complex than it initially looked, because the reason that this came up in the first place is there are some tracks in the Paluxy Riverbed close to Glen Rose that, with a little imagination, look somewhat human. There are also some completely fake carvings out there. And so when the people I talked to in Glen Rose spoke to me about the tracks, some of them were speaking about the ones in the riverbed that were sort of mysterious, and some were speaking about things that they knew to be outright fakes. The ones that are in the riverbed have been determined by paleontologists to be dinosaur tracks. The ones that are photographed in the story are clear carvings. I think it's sort of like the crop circles in that the fact that a couple of guys showed up and said, we've created all these crop circles and they're fake, sort of muddied the waters for everybody. You know, there's still some people who believe. So a few years ago, I want to tell you how I got the idea for the story. So a few years ago, a friend and I went to New Braunfels, and there's some, outside of New Braunfels, there are some tracks in a place called Canyon Lake. And they're dinosaur tracks. They're not in a state park. They're just in some private land. And when they were building some tennis courts there, they found these tracks, so they decided to stop, and now you can go visit the tracks. Well, while we were there, we went into the museum next door and got into a conversation with the docent about other visitors and where did they come from. And she mentioned that sometimes people who come to that museum ask where the human tracks are because they've been to Glen Rose, and they've seen human and dinosaur tracks in Glen Rose, too. And so I said, wait, what? And then she told me that there's this museum, which I ended up visiting, the Creation Evidence Museum. Which is the source of that idea.
So you spent some time talking to folks in Glen Rose, and it seems like a lot of them, or some of them at least, are what, I guess the technical term is, are young Earth creationists. So they believe the world is only 6,000 or 7,000 years old based on a very literal interpretation of the Bible. So, but they're also confronted with this evidence of dinosaur tracks. So to reconcile this, and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, so to reconcile that, some of them believe that humans and dinosaurs coexisted. They sort of walked side by side in the not so distant past.
Right. And the term young Earth creationist is probably not a term that a lot of people would claim. What I learned is that there's a whole school of creationist thinking and of creation science. And there are young Earth creationists, and then there are those who, in general, believe the world was created by God, but don't necessarily, a literal interpretation of the Genesis accounts is not that important to them. So I think that a lot of the people I spoke with in Glen Rose are young Earth creationists, but wouldn't necessarily identify as such.
Right.
And I also think it's important to say that this thinking is not probably unique to Glen Rose. I mean, I think that these conversations happen a lot of places in many small towns across Texas and surely outside Texas. It's just that in Glen Rose, you have this physical artifact of the tracks in the river that have been interpreted as human. And that's why people kind of have to take a stand on it in
right.
Glen Rose in a way that they might not someplace else. I talked to a lot of people, and I tried to start the conversation by asking them about the tracks, first about the dinosaur tracks, and then if they had heard of these human tracks. And some people went straight to creation versus evolution. To them, it was about a fight between creation and evolution in terms of how to account for the origins of the universe. Other people didn't feel that passionate about it. They were sort of open to the idea that humans and dinosaurs coexisted, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talked to a few people who I would say solidly came down on the side of science. One of them is Mike Dooley, who's mentioned in the story, who's a businessman. A couple other people who probably don't want me to mention them on the record. I talked to a woman on the way out of town who's not in the story, who started the first bar in Glen Rose. And when I brought this up, she said, oh, I don't even really know about that. I'm completely agnostic about
that. I want to stop there. Okay. So a couple of the people that were in the science camp were scared to talk on the record.
Mm-hmm.
So, were there folks on the creationist side that were afraid to talk on the record?
No, I think the folks on the creationist side are very, tend to be a little bit more passionate about their views. I mean, there are folks who were just sort of entertaining the idea that humans and dinosaurs coexisted, but then there were some who felt very strongly about it. And an example of that is Mary Adams, who's in the story, and she's the niece of one of the men who found the tracks. And for her, she said that the theory of evolution was the worst thing that had ever happened to
yeah.
her because of her life circumstances that she associated with evolution. And so she made a presentation to the youth at her church about how if anyone sort of came to them and offered them evolution like they might be offered drugs, they should turn it down and walk
just
away.
Just say no.
Exactly. And there were a number of other people that I probably could have talked to. There's one particular Baptist church in town whose minister is connected with the Creation Evidence Museum, and part of their statement of faith on their website is a belief in a literal interpretation of Genesis creation accounts. That may not be unique to them, but it's important enough to them to put it on their website. There's also an organization that goes to Israel and does archaeological digs, sort of with some of these same ideas in mind.
Hmm.
Well, it's kind of sad that these two scientists were afraid, I guess, to stick up for science. Were they from the town, or?
They were locals, and it's because of their job.
Uh-huh.
I think that they felt that they couldn't offer their personal views with their job title behind their name.
Uh-huh.
So how much detail did you go into with the folks who are the true blue young Earth creationists about how humans and dinosaurs coexisted? I mean,
very little, actually,
okay,
in terms of how did people not get eaten?
Well, yeah, and like, did people
right,
ride dinosaurs?
Considerations.
Like, did they have pet dinosaurs? Did they hang out or?
We didn't talk about that, and I actually don't think that.
Sorry.
I actually don't think that is the important thing. I think the important thing is where do you get the authority in your life, and so all of these sort of technical issues are not that important, and I think that's. To me, that's really the question that is contained in the story, and I think that's why people are reacting to it so much on the web, is what is the role of science in your life? What is the role of religion in your life? Can they intersect? Can they overlap? And then what are the implications of that? And so this was kind of talking to people about how do you know what you know? And if you're somebody who has an extremely strong faith-based belief system, to where you're going to discount things like radiometric dating that show how old layers of rock are, then the fact that you believe is the most important thing. And I think some of these things, like how did people not get killed by dinosaurs, are sort of technicalities.
So can we talk a little bit about what the reaction has been to your story? Like, what have the comments been and what have people been saying?
I think most people are not reacting so much to the story. They're reacting to this idea of science and religion. And I think they're also reacting to if religion is privileged over science, what kind of implications does that have in the public sphere? And I think that's a good question to ask, because if we discount aspects of science, you know, how old the Earth is doesn't necessarily affect any of our lives on a daily basis and the choices that we make or the products that we use. But if you extrapolate, science really does affect our lives on a daily basis. We use cell phones, we use antibiotics, we sometimes make policy changes about climate change or sex ed, or of course, most famously, what we teach in science classrooms about the origins of the world. And so I think that some people are responding to, or they're concerned about the implications that we would base these things on a religious belief system as opposed to a scientific one.
I have a question that might sound kind of flip, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How would a creationist write this article?
Oh, well, there's a question for you.
Well, because, I mean, you're very respectful about taking people's systems and on their own logic and treating them respectfully. At the same time, kind of, you know, stating what the science says pretty unequivocally. I'm just wondering, somebody who has a creationist worldview, what sort of article will they produce?
Okay, so I think a number of those articles have been produced. There are certain, this is really interesting, there are certain arguments that come up again and again in creationist circles about science and about the age of the Earth. And it was really fascinating to get into creation science, which has its own presses, its own scientific journals. Certainly various museums around the world demonstrate this viewpoint, particularly the one outside of Cincinnati, which is the biggest one. And so there are certain arguments that come up again and again. One of them is that carbon dating is not so effective as we might like it to be, which is true because carbon dating is limited to a certain range of time. So then you would look at other elements and when you're doing radiometric dating. But this is often used to discount how old we think layers of rock are. Mm-hmm. Another idea that comes up is that there are catastrophic events which made things look older than they were. For example, a volcano erupted and then the ash dried and compressed, and it ended up looking like it was much older than it actually was. So I think a creationist might approach these questions with some of those arguments in mind. And actually, when I visited the Creation Evidence Museum, I heard some of those arguments presented in Carl Baugh's lecture, and then I heard some other people talking about them later. And then I talked to a couple of students from Baylor University who were there, who were very interested in uncovering the truth that hadn't been presented to them in school. And they also told me some of the same arguments.
Hmm. So this has been good for the economy, the local economy in Glen Rose. I know that I know Glen Rose from the nuclear reactor, mm-hmm. and also from John Graves' book, A Goodbye to River, was sort of about this part of Texas. But you suggested here that the kind of the Creation Museum, Science Museum has been, and the state park have been, you know, good for the local economy.
Certainly, the state park is the biggest attraction, and there's also Dinosaur World, which is you walk through and see different colored dinosaurs, kind of models about them, and informative plaques. There's also the Fossil Rim Wildlife Center, which is kind of a really nice drive-through safari, so that's a big attraction. There's a couple of golf courses, which were built with nuclear money. There's the amphitheater and the Passion Play. So there's a lot of reasons to go spend money in Glen Rose. The Creation Evidence Museum is not itself something that brings a lot of money to the city, but I think it brings really dedicated tourists. I think probably the level of passion among those who come to the Creation Evidence Museum is higher.
Do they have a gift shop there?
They do.
What can you get there?
You can get books authored by the founder and curator, Carl Baugh, and by other people who share similar ideas. It's mostly books, videotapes, and DVDs, some of them costing up to $60.
So they have bumper stickers or t-shirts that say you can't make a chain out of missing links?
They actually don't.
This, one of the high school science teachers, there's two of them in my high school, she had a bumper sticker on her podium that said that. That was for the creationist kids.
I think that's relevant. Yeah, and that's what I think that these conversations probably happen in a lot of other places, because in my hometown, I remember going into seventh grade science, which was life science, and there were two teachers, and I remember hearing one of my classmates say that she and her mom really wanted her to get into a particular teacher's class because creationism would be presented.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely the same thing for me, yeah.
Well, on that note, I think we should probably wrap this episode up. Forrest and I need to go print some bumper stickers and sell them as quickly as possible. But this has been the fourth episode of the Texas Observer podcast. You can find previous episodes of this show on texasobserver.org, as well as the articles that we talked about in this installment. We'll see you in 2 weeks.